Section 4. Whigs Support Development. As you read, look for improvements to public education under Whig leadership, how the coming of the railroads changed the state, the growth of welfare institutions and the chartering of private academies and colleges, advances in industry and mining, and the following terms: curriculum, literate, plank road. In North Carolina, Nathaniel Macon and his allies had been strong supporters of President Jackson because they wanted farm families to be left alone to make their own opportunities whenever possible. Because Macon had the support of the East, that section mostly voted Democratic in the 1830s and 1840s. In contrast, those who opposed Macon became Whigs because they wanted to use government money and other financial resources to build up the state. The followers of Archibald Murphy soon formed the North Carolina Whig Party. Because they had the support of the West and parts of the Tidewater that liked Murphy's call for dredging the Sounds, the Whigs controlled the state in the 1830s and 1840s. The first Whig leader in the state was John Motley Moorhead. The Virginia native had been one of David Caldwell's last students at the Log College. After graduating from the university, Moorhead studied law with Murphy. He then became a planter and a cotton mill owner in Spray on the Dan River, where the town of Eden is today. Moorhead helped with the constitutional reforms of 1835. He was elected governor in 1840 and again in 1842. Moorhead and other Whigs pushed forward both parts of Murphy's plan, public education and internal improvements. Improvements in education and literacy. In 1839, the Whigs created the state's first public school system. The plan called for each county to hold an election to decide if it wanted to tax itself to build common schools that any white child, girl or boy, could attend free. If local taxes were raised, the state would supplement the plan with money from a rejuvenated, restored, literary fund. Once a county provided the funds, each neighborhood was to get a school. The plan to build academies was never enacted, but the slack was taken up by the denominations, branches of Christianity, which by the 1830s had institutions for both boys and girls. Rockingham County opened the first common school in 1840. This was Governor Moorhead's home county. By the 1850s, every county developed common schools. In addition, the state had developed a school system to make sure as many white children as possible received a decent education. Rockingham County opened the first common school in 1840. This was Governor Moorhead's home county. By the 1850s, every county developed common schools. In addition, the state had developed a school system to make sure as many white children as possible received a decent education. In 1852, Calvin H. Wiley of Guilford County became the first superintendent of public instruction. Wiley introduced standards for teachers and published a magazine to help teachers improve their skills. He also wrote the first textbook on North Carolina history. By then, North Carolina had the most extensive school system of any place in the South during the antebellum era. During the same period, the university in Chapel Hill also grew. Former Governor David Swain became its president, and enrollment tripled under his leadership. Swain also broadened the curriculum, the courses offered, to include the study of law and agricultural chemistry, two subjects with great practical benefit for a farming state. By the 1850s, more North Carolinians were literate, able to read and write, than ever before, and they had more of their own literature to read. Many of the early books printed in the state had a religious theme. They were either collections of sermons or a short history of a particular denomination. One of the most popular was a biography of the acclaimed educator, the Reverend David Caldwell. Calvin H. Wiley, the superintendent of public instruction, published novels with the well-known titles of Alamance and Roanoke. Mary Bayard Clark, in 1854, edited the first collection of North Carolina poetry. 60 poets were included. The coming of the railroads. In the 1830s, the invention of the railroad became one of the most important things ever to happen to the state. A railroad could be built almost anywhere. At last, North Carolina had a way to easily ship its goods to the rest of the world. Railroads, however, were very expensive to build, especially in a poor state. Eager to revive the state, both Whigs and Democrats in the legislature, during the reform period, voted to use public money to invest in the new technology. The first railroad, which connected the state capital to the Roanoke River area, failed to make money, but the second, the Wilmington and Weldon, was the biggest success in state history. It ran through the heart of the coastal plain and allowed farmers there to lower the costs of shipping. The state's first railroads helped only the East. Western leaders convinced the legislature to establish the North Carolina Railroad, NCRR. The NCRR was routed from Goldsboro to Charlotte, through Raleigh, Greensboro, and Salisbury. The state put up 2/3 of the needed funds. Former Governor Moorhead, the largest private investor, became its president. He also headed a private effort to extend the line from Goldsboro to Beaufort. The new community at the end of the line was called Moorhead City. About that time, a western line was built from Salisbury to Morganton, and another was laid from Wilmington to Charlotte. What a change the railroads brought! For the first time since the settlement of Roanoke, North Carolina was on the map, gaining the attention of the whole world. When they were new, first the Wilmington and Weldon at 161 miles, then the NCRR at 223 miles, were the longest railroads in the world. North Carolinians believed that they had finally caught up with progress elsewhere. As one supporter argued, the rest of the country would come to see and appreciate the enterprise and talents of Old Rip. The impact of the railroads could be seen in the fields. Planters on the coastal plain tripled the amount of cotton they grew. Tobacco farms multiplied in counties along the Virginia line, especially when a railroad reached Danville. Caswell County grew so much tobacco during the 1850s that it became the richest county in the state. In the Uwharries, farmers learned that their flinty soil could grow very fine wheat. The railroads had an impact on the development of towns in the state. Goldsboro, High Point, and Hickory grew up around important railroad sidings, stretches of track used for storage or slow-passing trains. Company shops, the community that developed around the NCRR repair yards, was soon surrounded by what became known as the town of Burlington. The largest town not to get a railroad, Fayetteville, resorted to a cheaper innovation. It supported the construction of plank roads, often called farmer railroads, made out of planks laid out like a deck across the roadbed. The plank road enabled farmers to keep their wagons above the mud and ruts that had slowed travel in the past. Plank roads extended from Fayetteville across the Uwharries all the way to Taylorsville. The longest one connected Fayetteville with Salem, crossing the NCRR at High Point. These toll roads worked well for a few years, but high maintenance costs due to rain and rot led to their abandonment. Social improvements. The spirit of development spread across the state and had an impact on most citizens. To care for North Carolina's impaired citizens, the state set up several welfare institutions. Governor Moorhead convinced the legislature to set up a school for the deaf and blind. What would later be called the Governor Moorhead School was opened in Raleigh during the 1840s for citizens from across the state. In 1849, after a special plea from Dorothea Dix of Massachusetts, a pioneer in the proper care of people suffering from mental illness, the state established the Hospital for the Insane in West Raleigh. The site was opened in 1853. It soon came to be called Dix Hill, to honor Miss Dix. The Whig legislature also encouraged the chartering of private academies and colleges. The principal Christian denominations in the state during the 1830s established schools to train their young men to be ministers and lay leaders. In 1834, the Baptist Literary Institute was opened 20 miles north of Raleigh. It later became Wake Forest College. The college did not move to Winston-Salem until the 1950s. Quakers opened New Garden Boarding School in 1837. A half century later, it grew into Guilford College. Presbyterians north of Charlotte set up Davidson College in 1837, naming it for the fallen hero of the Battle of Cowan's Ford. In 1838, Methodists established a small school to train teachers in the village of Trinity in Randolph County. Originally called the Normal Institute, it was later reorganized as Trinity College. In 1885, it was moved to Durham and later grew into Duke University. Support for educating women became more widespread once the trains brought prosperity. The Moravians had started Salem Female Academy in 1802. That school offered the best higher education for women in the state for decades. During the 1840s, each of the major denominations also set up schools for young women. Greensboro Female College for Methodists, St. Mary's in Raleigh for Episcopalians, and Chowan Baptist Female Institute in Murfreesboro. All three still exist, but have changed through the years. Industrial beginnings. The Whigs also chartered cotton mills, setting the stage for the later growth of that industry in the state. There had been a few mills before the 1830s reforms, most notably the cotton mills on the South Fork of the Catawba River near Lincolnton and at the falls of the Tar River, where the town of Rocky Mount was established. A dozen more factories were set up in the 1840s. Most were located on tributaries of the Cape Fear River, since marketing of the cloth was easily done in Fayetteville. The largest was at Rockfish, near the site of today's town of Hope Mills. Edwin M. Holt ran the best-known mill, the Alamance Factory, near the site of the Regulator Battlefield. The Holts produced the first dyed cloth in the state in 1852. They called their product Alamance Plaid. Soon, other factories made their own brands of plaid. As Alamance Plaid became North Carolina's first famous product, the state itself was becoming well-known for moving ahead in many social and economic areas. The telegraph was first installed in the state in 1848, which helped North Carolinians communicate more closely with the rest of the nation. The number of people who lived in towns doubled. Between 1835 and 1850, the number of newspapers published in the state more than doubled. Raleigh and Fayetteville had daily newspapers. By that time, there was much more to read about, for North Carolinians had begun to move forward in their daily lives. They began to brag that the old North State was no longer asleep. They had the first state university in the nation, the most elegant state capital in the country, a plentiful and varied soil, and a steady, sober, industrious population. Mary Bayard Clark, one of the first poets in the state, extolled, "Old Rip is awakening. His years of slumber at last have gone by, and the rainbow of promise illuminates the sky." Mining. North Carolina had been known as a gold-producing state ever since the John Reed family opened the nation's first significant gold mine in Cabarrus County in the early 1800s. Prospectors rushed to the area to pan for gold in Uwharrie streams. By the 1830s, mine owners were sinking shafts deep into the ground. At one time, 50 mines were in operation. Several mines were dug under the town of Charlotte. So much gold was found in the central part of the state that the federal government established a branch of the United States Mint there in 1837. West of Charlotte, so much gold was found in streams that Christopher Bechtler, and later his son and his nephew, ran a private mint near Rutherfordton from 1831 to 1849. Special feature: Carolina Places, Reed Gold Mine. In the early 1800s, when most North Carolinians struggled to get by, a few state residents got rich. None of them were richer than the Reeds of Cabarrus County. They literally found gold in their own backyard. John Reed had been a Hessian soldier in Cornwallis's army during the Revolution. He deserted and came to live with other Germans on Dutch Buffalo Creek. Reed was said to be honest but unlearned, and something of a primitive character. He was soon married to Sarah Kaiser. For 20 years, they eked out a living on meager soil, just like most folks in the backcountry. One Sunday in 1799, John's son Conrad spied a shiny rock in Little Meadow Creek and pulled it out. It was unusually yellow. The Reeds, unaware it was gold, decided to use it as their front doorstop. It lay on the front porch for 2 years. Like most farmers in the state, John Reed went to market every fall. In 1802, he went to Fayetteville. While there, he showed the rock to a silversmith. The craftsman knew it was gold. He also knew that he had a country bumpkin before him, so he shrewdly asked Reed to name his price for the rock. Reed asked for $3.50, the most money he had ever gotten for any one thing in his life. The Reed children later recalled that their excited father splurged and bought coffee for the first time in his life. Meanwhile, the silversmith sold the 17-pound gold nugget for $3,600. Word soon got back to the Reeds that they had been cheated. They and some neighbors went looking for more gold. In 1803, Peter Love, a neighbor's slave, dug down 6 inches into the stream and came up with a 28-pound nugget. The Reeds sent the nugget to the Federal Mint in Philadelphia and made a big profit. For the next several years, the Reeds, their slaves, and their neighbors continued to dig holes up and down Little Meadow Creek. They found that most of the gold was about 4 feet deep, level with the nearby stream bed. Sometimes they dug up gold like potatoes, finding as much as 20 pounds in a day. When they did not turn up nuggets, they sifted the soil with rockers to separate the heavier gold from the lighter dirt. The Reeds and their partners expanded from creek mining to underground mining in 1831. By this time, more than 50 mines had been started in that area of the backcountry. Farmers looked for gold from Greensboro all the way south to Charlotte. During this time, John Reed continued to live like the typical North Carolinian. His house was larger than that of his neighbors, but he still farmed his own fields. Reed even forbade his sons from digging holes for gold in planted fields. When John Reed died in 1845, the family's fortunes began to change. His children agreed to share what they would find in the mine. However, the family began to argue about how much each would get. The mine was closed down for a decade as family members sued one another. Eventually, the mine was sold, first in 1846, then again in 1853. Although the new owners sank deep shafts into the ground and tried to use new technology to extract more gold, they did not make a profit. The Reed Mine passed from owner to owner after the Civil War. The last real nugget was found in 1896. The mine was closed during the first half of the 20th century. Its last private owner donated the land to the state in 1962, and the state made it a historic site in 1976. Since that time, it has been one of the most visited places in the state. Mining section continued. The most famous mine site became Gold Hill, started in 1842 at the edge of the Uwharries in Rowan County. At the height of activities during the 1850s, Gold Hill had 15 mines in the space of a square mile. Shafts were dug down 800 feet. More than 3,000 people worked the mines in rotating shifts. The gold was processed out of the ore using 7 steam engines. Many of the miners were immigrants from Europe, including experienced miners from Cornwall, England. North Carolinians tried to mine other valuable products. Iron ore was taken out of the Cranberry Mine located in the mountains west of the present town of Spruce Pine. Several iron furnaces were operated near the ore bank on the South Fork of the Catawba River. These furnaces produced iron plugs that blacksmiths could use to make tools and household items. The largest operation was at the Vesuvius Furnace in Lincoln County. North Carolina's first coal mine opened in 1855 at Cumnock in what became Lee County. The Egypt Mine, as it was called, operated through the Civil War.